Talk given Sunday, October 22nd, 1972. How very seldom the deepest longings of the soul are fulfilled. These longings are spoilt in expression in our own minds by our conditioning, by our state of ignorance, of confusion. One longs to hear the word of love spoken, the word of wisdom uttered. One longs that someone shall speak the word of peace, and brotherhood will fill the world. But when, where do we ever hear the true word of love spoken? And also, let me put it the other way, the word of true love spoken. And is not that the same with the word of peace and the word of wisdom? Why is man incapable of using that wonderful faculty he has, the faculty of speech, to speak the word, to utter the sound of power which shall bring love and wisdom and peace and healing to the world? We must realize the word of love can be spoken by transcendence. The word of peace, the word of wisdom, can also be spoken by transcendence. It is spoken, it has been spoken, by the perfected holy ones. See how the world has requited them. We are deaf. We are insensitive. So we constantly hurt each other. And the person who genuinely, sincerely pours out his or her life and experience to give comfort to another, to bring some understanding to another, is requited by being hurt, by being rejected. Now the spoken word is one which should truly represent transcendence within us. I am mentioning this today because, if you remember, those of you who were here last fortnight on the Sunday, we talked about yoga during the latter part of the afternoon, and I mentioned something which, although I say it myself, is really of the profoundest importance. And this was in connection with speech and our faculty of speech. You remember, we talked about the different centers, as they are called in the body, the different chakras, the three so-called lower ones, which symbolically represent our worldly consciousness, our worldly life, especially all our dealings in connection with food, sex, and the commerce of everyday life. And you may remember I mentioned that all our ordinary speech in everyday life emerges out of this aspect of our living. And this speech is the speech of confusion, of self-centeredness, of ignorance, of violence, of fear, and so on. And on those very rare occasions when it purports to be the speech of love, it really stands more often than not for the speech of passion, for the speech of possessing another's body and soul. When this speech purports to be the speech of wisdom, it is the speech of cleverness. It is the speech of cunning, of artifice to gain one's own ends. The speech of diplomacy. And if it is supposed to be the speech of peace, it means the speech which is trying to say, to assert, that you shall live, behave, and have the relationship with me which I want you to have. So that this is untrue speech. All this belies the fundamental fact about our humanity, namely that humanity in its fullness is no other than divinity. It is with respect to all this worldly speech that we have to learn the great lesson of silence. As and when we do understand, begin to understand, shall I say, the real significance of speech, the real meaning of our humanity, and when, to use the symbolic terms of yoga, the so-called higher centers begin to be operative in the real sense, then our speech leaves aside this realm of worldliness as far as one's main interests in life are concerned. Worldly speech is necessary because we live in the world, and we shall always live in the world. But the speech which is the speech of living in the world, is also of the world for the majority. And we have to grow out of that, to outgrow that speech. When these higher centers, as we call them, function, then one is aware of oneself and of existence no longer in terms of worldliness, but in terms of the full, free functioning of our religiousness. And at heart, our religiousness means our being in communion, in unending communion, in beginningless communion with the totality. Which implies that all separative self-consciousness, all thought and feeling, speech and action, which is rooted in selfness, in selfness, is no longer operative. It is not there. One is in communion. So that although to our eyes each person as a body is visible as a separate self, that person is not separate from the totality. He is integral part and parcel of this totality. And he is awake, fully awake and responding to that fact. What will be his speech then? Will not his speech express that awakenedness, that communion, in terms of the truth, the reality of love, of wisdom, of peace? And a person who, in some degree or other, has entered that realm will never need or ask or demand or crave for love or truth or peace or wisdom or anything at all. He will be the truly alone, the truly unlonely. Because in that total aloneness, which is the aloneness of the full awakening to communion with totality, there is no separation, and therefore there is no loneliness. And if there is no loneliness, there is no dependent longing for a little affection, for a little sympathy, for a little understanding, for support from anything or anybody. You see, this is our real, natural, human state. We, being what we are, immature, ignorant, still in the bud stage, which may very well be nipped someday, you see. We being in that stage say that, oh, what you're talking of is something superhuman. It isn't. I say very categorically and simply, this is the meaning of being human. When transcendent love, wisdom, goodness, simplicity manifest freely through the living organism, naturally through the living organism, then that is the human state. Then one is indeed the Son of Man. So our speech then will be of quite a different order from the noises that we otherwise make in the world. Just consider it for yourself. Is not this so? And then that speech, which is the true meaning of the term prophetic speech, the true meaning of prophesying, will be speech which has creative power in it. what we commonly call the Word of God in the theistic religions. And God said, and there was what he said. I've said this before, but remember, rather than translate the original as, and God said, let us put it this way, and God minded, and there was. Because mind in its real sense is creative energy and nothing else. And because it is creative energy, it is everything. Because the totality of manifestation is the expression, that which is pressed out of this creative power, this creative energy, which is perpetual creation, perpetually creating. Try to get the sense of this, the feel of it, quite calmly. Not as something which you may acquire, not as something which will bring you as an individual healing and peace and assuagement of pain, but just feel it out quite naturally and simply. And you will discover that you have removed the obstruction to an inexhaustible wellspring of strength within yourself. The strength which never oppresses but which everlastingly sustains. An inexhaustible well of the power to understand, to be utterly sensitive to your neighbor, whether your neighbor is a human being or an animal or a tree, whether your neighbor is a chair or a piano or a carpet or a stone or a corpse, whatsoever is next to you is your neighbor. And when that happens, and it does happen that way, when that happens, you will find that your neighbor, whatsoever the outward appearance of that neighbor, is no other than eternal God. Now you don't have to try or strive or aspire any longer to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength. It just is your natural state. And your speech is the utterance of power that can inspire rightly and transform the listener who cares to listen to you. Cares for reality, for truth, for life. And if he cares that way, he will find that he has listened not only to the voice of truth, to the voice of God, he has listened to himself in his own transcendent aloneness. Therefore, he is not dependent upon what he hears. Something like this, as far as I can see, something like this is a goal. I'm deliberately using that phrase, is a goal. For us human beings, it expresses the flowering out of the process which takes place through the whole of humanity and which comes to fruition only through particular individuals, if the individual does not obstruct the process of coming to fruition. I said, is a goal. There are few people in the world who do not have a goal, or maybe two or three or several goals. The person who is inclined towards religion, whatever the cause may be or the influence may be which moved him towards religion, the person who is inclined towards religion and is sincere about it will definitely state, oh yes, of course, I know precisely what my goal is. The kingdom of heaven, nirvana, moksha, if he's a Hindu, he will use that word, liberation, perfection, utter purification, saintship, call it what you will. That is my goal, he'll say. Is not that the very defeating of the reality of the goal? The goal is transcendent. And as transcendence, it is not a goal. A goal is a finite, limited, particular, petty little thing. When I say my goal is perfection or nirvana or the kingdom of heaven or to be Christ-like or Buddha-like or whatever it is, what am I doing? I am making a picture in my mind. Without ever being conscious of my remarkable foolishness and childishness, that I, a mere mortal, let me use the Catholic phrase, born in sin, can picture transcendence. In fact, totality, the immeasurable, the eternal, is going to be put into this ephemeral cloud floating about in cuckoo land. My goal. You see the folly of it. The utter impracticability of it. I can never make thought shapes, thought forms, which represent the reality of transcendence. What can I do with my thought process then? And my mental perception, as I call it, or power of perception. All I can do is to see the ways in which I misunderstand. All the ways in which I spoil the reality of transcendence, introduce shadows where in reality there is only eternal light. But if there is eternal light, there is no particular limited form to obstruct that light and make shadows, which means that the mind must be totally open, totally empty, in other words, of all the little forms of thought that I set up. You see the difficulty of the task straight away. Don't make transcendence a goal. Just let our eyes be shut in reverence before that awful majesty. You can put it in any terms you like, theistic or non-theistic or personal or impersonal or transpersonal, if you like. But remember that all the terms in which you put it are obstructions to the reality. If we are awake to that, that all our terms and thought forms are obstructions to the reality, the thought which arises at the moment will have some lesson for oneself, which one must try to perceive, and let the thought go. Because when one does that, when one doesn't grasp, and lets the thought, the idea, the system of philosophy and so forth teach us its lesson, and we let it go, then our inner faculty of pure intelligence, the faculty to perceive the reality of things as they are, the unspeakable truth as it is, that faculty grows, becomes more and more powerful. And in that growth, there emerges one's salvation. One's salvation is the same as one's own healing, one's own wholeness, holiness. So you see, we will naturally, of course, set up goals. It's impossible to avoid it. This thing happens. But each time it happens, perceive, understand, learn, and let go the goal. And that way you will find that life in its purity emerges and a new state of consciousness and being emerges out of it. And when you let it go that way, you will also let go imposed, rigid disciplines. Every particular method which is sought, which is practiced, is something which binds. A method, a way, a practice emerges, should emerge spontaneously in the living moment. It emerges spontaneously in the living moment because you really care. To really care means really to love, which means to have no selfness involved in it, no demand for oneself, no hope, no expectation, and all the rest of it. And if you really care, then in the immediate moment, spontaneously, naturally, your way, your practice, your method emerges alive. It is alive in the moment. And whatsoever is alive grows. And that means it changes. But if you cling to a method, if you cling to a set routine, then you are forcing yourself into a tomb. Whatsoever method is presented to you in the course of the living interplay with other human beings, and it stimulates you, inspires you, by all means experiment with it. Practice, but don't cling to it. That is the whole thing. Don't cling to it. Don't ask yourself, oh, how long shall I go on with this and then let it go? Because if anyone answers that question for you, another imposition has been made upon you, the living creature. You're not living then. You see, hardly a human being accepts, understands the real implication of individuality. It is, the real implication, amongst other things, is non-dependence. Non-dependence does not mean independence in the separative, self-assertive sense. We are all completely and totally interrelated with each other, in fact. Insofar as I see the true nature of that fact, the interrelationship grows stronger and stronger, in fact, not weaker. But if I see that, then I become increasingly non-dependent. That means not a liability upon you, upon the environment. But how is it with the world? Aren't we all little liabilities, at least? And some are more than little liabilities. You see, this non-dependence is completely related to the realization of aloneness in the inner depth of consciousness. When that aloneness is realized in the inner depth of consciousness, you will discover that in this whole universe, there is no such thing as otherness. You will discover there is only oneness, which manifests this extraordinary, magical, wonderful thing, a variety in terms of multitudinousness. You remember in the Bhagavad Gita when Sri Krishna reveals his true nature to Arjuna. One of the things he says, there is no end to my glories, to the wonder and the marvel in me. How is that? One single person, you would say, infinite in wonder and glory and marvel and all the rest of it? Yes. Because one single person, you, yourself, in your wholeness, are the totality. Who is or what is the other for you when your full humanity has come to fulfillment? To realization. And you see, this is perhaps one of the profoundest meanings of the word yoga. No selfness in me whatsoever. And yet behold the universe in my one body, as Sri Krishna said. Behold the universe in my one body. Don't let us get swept away by the magnificence of the idea. Because we shall get a wonderful intellectual thrill, you know. Our pleasure lust will be satisfied. And the very next moment, all that wonder will have a bucket of dirty water thrown over it. That's our tragedy and our loss and misery. So it is important that we should look within ourselves. Look very carefully. Look very searchingly. Look lovingly. Look non-possessively, wanting a gain, something to be gained for oneself. Look that way. And in the looking, with the intensity of the looking, there will be the transformation process going on. I must have said this not 101, but 1001 times by now. Where the psyche, where the soul is concerned, the act of seeing the truth of what actually is the power that transforms that which is imperfect into the perfect. Without ever needing any definition from us or any thought image from us as to what the perfect ought to be. Let me never descend to the folly of trying to lay down for transcendence what transcendence ought to be or do or what shape it shall take. And if I am free from that, what happens? The whole of life is seen as beauty. Not merely beauty of form and manifestation, which has all its constraining criteria and standards of judgment and all the rest of it. Not merely that. But this mysterious principle of beauty, this mode of awareness in its full livingness, which cannot be constrained or defined, that itself is the beauty. There are no yardsticks for it. I amused myself a few months ago, actually at the Buddhist summer school, just very quickly measuring out the universe, you see. And I made it out at approximately 6 million cubic kilometers. I did this, I amused myself this way, not out of vanity or conceit or anything, but because I wanted to make a point at the group meeting that afternoon. Namely, that our fundamental duality is I, the self, and everything else, the not-self. So this little object, this little worm, shall we say, is the self, which is so vivid in my consciousness and so supremely important that I cannot get rid of the word or the thought or the consciousness of I. This is the self, very vivid, and 6 multiplied by 10 to the power 30, just a little bit, oh, that's all the not-self, just dismissed like that. You know who could be our best friend time and again? One elf-like creature named Puck. Lord, what fools these mortals be. So, let us not try to measure transcendence, to picture transcendence, to imagine it. To lay down that God is so-and-so, 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 so-and-so. We can say a few things, even with our foolish worldly wisdom, what God is not, in terms of our human being and existence. not evil. Not uncreative. Not asleep. But fully awake. Awake with an awakening which is unimaginable to us, as we are. But it is that very unimaginable awakening which is ours when we have really begun to see. Now, when we awaken that way, some extraordinary things begin to happen. The word of anger, or the word of hate, or the act of violence which comes to us, if we are wholly sensitive to it, even the least bit awakened to transcendence, howsoever much that word or act may hurt, we learn out of it, we absorb it, and that in that absorbing into our, the innermost being of our whole psyche, we transmute it. Time and again, for example, in the Buddhist suttas, the Buddhist scriptures, you will find this kind of statement by the Buddha himself, time and again. And then I directed a mind of loving kindness. And the robber intending to murder, to steal, was quelled. A rutting elephant who was sent to get rid of the Buddha, to kill him off, kneeled down and saluted him. These are lovely symbolic ways, lovely myths, which convey profound truths, psychological truths. So, this is the sort of thing that we will find. Not because that man's word or act was anything but violent and horrible and evil, but because my otherness from him was absent in my own consciousness, and in my psychical being, that evil was transformed into good. No one knows how this affects the environment, how it affects the world. In the psychical world, all humanity is one. Every one of us affects the psyche of mankind, and the psyche of everyone else affects the totality of mankind, including oneself. And in this process, speech plays an extremely important part, because speech implies also the thought and the feeling. There's no speech without thought and feeling. Now, if we really understand this, not only coldly, logically, intellectually, but with great inward sensitivity, warm, heartfelt sensitivity, if we understand it that way, then we will understand why all the great spiritual teachers laid such tremendous emphasis upon what seemed to us common little things. We know all about that, we feel like saying. They simply told us to be truthful, not to be malicious, slanderous, rude in our speech. Don't we know all those things? Didn't we learn all that on our mother's lap? And what happens? What has happened? Aren't we rude? Aren't we lying? Aren't we malicious? slanderous, possessed of a venomous tongue. You see, just sort of feel this intensely and let it slip out. Better still, let it all get converted into that which is sheer beauty, a power of beauty, loving kindness within oneself, which inevitably radiates out. And then the goal will of its own accord be more and more manifest through oneself, the very lovable, the adorable, the wonderful, the beautiful, the marvelous human being who is your own self.